Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. Today, I get to speak with Dr. Yonut Moyes, who is a tutor in comparative philosophy at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, which I've recently discovered and I'm fascinated by, at least in terms of their online offerings, and we'll definitely dive into that. But more to the point of this interview, we'll be talking with Yonut about his new Routledge 2019 book, Salvation in Indian Philosophy, Perfection and Simplicity for Vaisheshika. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Raj.
So maybe tell us a little bit about what you do at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. I'm not sure if you're aware, but I recently discovered their online courses, I think maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I was ignorant of that initiative, and it looks like a fantastic way for folks to dive into Hindu studies at various levels of existing knowledge. Are you currently teaching a course there?
Yes, indeed. I teach comparative philosophy for the Hindu Center. It's a course which I designed myself, drawing comparisons between regarding various concepts common to Greek philosophy and Indian philosophy, with parallels to to Gnosticism and patristics theology. It's a course designed or aimed at visiting students from Denmark who come to the Hindu Center to immerse themselves into Hindu studies with Oxford University.
That's very interesting. I think while you were there, you were also part of some sort of collaborative or exchange program. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's a collaborative exchange between the University of Aarhus in Denmark and Oxford University.
Fascinating. So your book, Salvation in Indian Philosophy, what is it about? What's the main point, takeaway, argument of your book?
Well, I should start perhaps to clarify first about the title of my book, which is rather a misnomer. From Indian studies point of view, Salvation is not quite the right title for this book. Partly because it's a term that comes from the Greco-Latin via Latin scholasticism literature. It comes to us in English language from the Latin salveo, which is a term originally from French. And the term has generally a theological and Greco-Latin underpinning. Therefore, a better title for the book is, in my opinion, Liberation. In fact, when I say salvation in Indian philosophy, I talk simply about liberation in Indian philosophy, and that is designated by the term moksha or nishreyasa, moksha, which is a more familiar term.
So could you tell us then could you explain then how salvation rather than liberation became the title?
Well, initially I wanted to produce a book not exclusively on Vaisheshika system, but rather on several other philosophical systems. The title I put forward was Indian Theories of Salvation. And I had looked over Nyaya, Vedanta, Samkhya, one Buddhist school, Vaibhashika, which is a realistic school, and Jaina. And then the initial title was Indian Theories of Salvation.
And so you seem to prefer the idea of liberation to describe the content of what you're talking about. So why salvation or liberation if salvation is a misnomer?
I wanted, in fact, to clarify for theologians and religious studies scholars that I do not confuse terms, either for post-colonial theorists. My attempt would be classified as a Europe-centered approach, or from the part of apologists, Christian apologists, and would probably be classified as an attempt to steal the term and apply it to another religion. Well, I have clarified in my introduction that this book does not aim to do any kind of confusion, nor any definitive answer on spiritual seeking, but rather to talk about salvation as a concept which exists in other philosophical systems and religions. And it is for this matter that I want to clarify from the beginning that from the Christian point of view, salvation is neither perfected nor simple. From an Indian point of view, it is exactly that is it aimed at reaching a state of complete perfection and simplicity. Whereas in Christianity, for example, there is salvation neither perfected, because perfection is continuous, nor is simple, because it's like Paul writes in one of his letters, is the movement from glory to glory. So it's a continual dynamic. Whereas in Indian world, the journey is the other way around. It's a beginning from the dynamics towards reaching a state of non-return static state, rather than going to a dynamic as in the Christian and worldview.
So I certainly understand the need to render work through titles that are broad and accessible to people. Your book is part of the same series in which, for example, a recent book of mine came out. It's called, quote unquote, The Goddess and the Sun in Indian Myth. Now, who knows what myth is? Who knows if myth is the proper word? Ideally, perhaps it would be something along the lines of, you know, Durga and Surya in Purana literature. But then who would know what that book is about remotely? So it's entirely understandable why you would have the broad and, in my view, appealing title of Salvation in Indian Philosophy. Nevertheless, thank you for your clarification about distinctions to disambiguate your work from other apologetic or other sorts of projects. So before we dive specifically into the perfection and the simplicity that you write about, could you give a little bit of an introduction in terms of Vaisheshika as a system or in terms of how you ended up studying Vaisheshika? You know, can you tell us a bit about that?
Vaisheshika is one of the earliest philosophies that developed in a post-Upanishadic or post-Shramanic period. Philosophy exclusively focused on the description of the world. It's a kind of natural philosophy. It's a robust ontology. By that I mean it tries to define the essence, the difference between quality, substances and qualities. It's about describing the ways in which these essences can be defined and expressed in language, although the linguistics are not very well developed in Vaisheshika. Nevertheless, its epistemology, which acknowledges perception and inference as two means of knowledge, has an ontological and essentialist orientation, if I can put it that simple. The category.
Great. So,
please.
Sorry, go on. Please go on.
The categories of Vaisheshika are six. So we have the substances, qualities, and actions. And on the top of them, we have the particularities. And here is where Vaisheshika Vaisheshika's originality lies. We have the universalities, and also we have the inherence, samavaya, which makes connections between these two particularities and universalities. So they are opposite, yet equivalent terms, in that they explain each other philosophically.
So, how does this system of thought, Vaisheshika, how does it relate to or pertain to the central concept of moksha that you're studying?
I think Vaisheshika, like many other systems of Indian philosophy, including Buddhism, begins from a simple but fundamental question, which is namely existential. What is the nature of the world and myself into this world? So to put it more simply, imagine the Heideggerian question of the existence of self into this world. Am I into the world or am I outside the world? So this kind of existential questions, the place of self in temporality and in the spatial cosmos, have been addressed by Vaisheshika very, very early. The point Vaisheshika makes is that between self, soul, and cosmos, there is an ontological distinction which should be overemphasized at the macro level. That is to say, soul is not only distinct from the cosmos, but from other types of souls. So everything in Vaisheshika is differentiated analytically, yet it has a connection in difference. In fact, the term Vishesha, from which Vaisheshika derives, means exactly that, particularity, difference. And it is that which is overworked in the system.
So this is an ancient Indian classical philosophical existential school that emphasizes the particularity of the self among other selves, and also the particularity of selfhood compared to the cosmos. Would you say that's the case?
Exactly. In fact, one student of Heidegger, Hans Jonas, defined existentialism as the philosophy of the particular. Well, this kind of definition, which has been so much developed in recent philosophy, is the kind of philosophy that Vaisheshika is an ontological existential philosophy that begins from the existence, from the question of the existence of the self, its individualized nature, in relation to the wider cosmos.
In terms of the comparative impulse, which I certainly can understand and respect, and often engage in when I'm looking at cross-cultural narratives, for example. In terms of your comparison, would you say you do so as to give us a richer way to understand Vaisheshika, or would you say you do so so that you can leverage Vaisheshika for understanding other systems of thought?
I think I do it more for contextualizing reasons. Indian philosophy is remote, is marginalized, partly because we do not know to contextualize it in a global context. Of course, what I'm doing with comparative philosophy is only an introduction to philosophy and is not philosophy per se.
What would you say your work seems to me to be, like most of our work, aiming at correcting perhaps or shifting a certain legacy of scholarship or a field? What would you say your project is shifting in scholarship or aiming to?
I suppose my project is mostly a continuation of similar approaches which have been done by the French scholar Masson Houssel, and also more recently by Wilhelm Halfas, who wrote a book on Vaisheshika, on being and what there is, and who strived, in fact, to do philosophy in this mode, in this comparative mode.
What is this? Tell us more about this simplicity and this perfection, crucial to your argument.
The perfection of simplicita of Vaisheshika, to which I referred, it was the way in which the self reaches through a kind of dualistic epistemology of differentiating and drawing similarities and connections between the world substances. The simplicity to which this system arrives is the state of the soul, which is devoid of its six, nine specific qualities, including cognition, including pleasure, pain, dharma and adharma, things which are difficult to translate now, and is also trying to look at the state, in fact, to find the state of the self that reaches a state which is differentiated and yet is simple, is removed of fluctuating things like volition and aversion, like latent impetus, like impression, let's say samskara, like cognition, as I said, dharma and adharma, and remaining as a result of this removal, the soul in Vaisheshika's salvation state is the self which is differentiated and yet static, in the sense that is no longer falling under the power of Adrishta, the power of Dharma and Adharma, the power of volition and aversion, of pleasure and pain, and of impressions, which remain in the self dormant, in a dormant state. The self in the ontological, in the soteriological state, in the state of salvation for Vaisheshika, is the one who remains with only six qualities, namely pratattva, which is a differentiated nature, which this means that the souls are plural in the outer world. They are not like in Vedanta, absorbed or identified with Brahman. It has a conjunction as disjunction, a kind of capacity to merge or separate. It has the capacity, it has the nature of number. So number is different than difference. The category of difference is not or should not be confused in Vaisheshika with the category of number. These things must be explained further into a future research. And this is, in fact, the description of the simple state in which the soul exists in the salvation of Vaisheshika. To put it simply, although the description is difficult because one needs to know these 9 plus 5 qualities of the self, it is the fact that the soul is no longer able to sense anything, even to know anything. It means that the soul has been simplified to a such extent that is unique and static at the same time. So one may ask probably, what is the beauty of this plain, simple state of Vaisheshika soteriology? The only beauty, and probably the greatest one, which has been so far neglected in other systems, is that the beauty of the soul in Vaisheshika's state of salvation is the difference. So everything that is different, that is unique, that is differentiated, that is the beauty of Vaisheshika's salvation. And that state is, at the same time, a state of simplicity. Because of the removal of such qualities as cognition, pleasure, pain, and so forth.
So this beauty of which you speak, along the lines of its refinement, its sort of, I think the word refinement comes to mind. It's a separation, but distinction from everything else. This discrete, simple, autonomous, perfected state. So for those of us who aren't as versed in Indian philosophy as you are, is this state in the school at all related to, say, the popular idea of the Atman being qualified by Sat Chit or Ananda? Is there any idea of enjoyment or bliss in this state?
No, I'm afraid not. And that was the reason for the ridicule which Vaisheshika has been subject to in the Middle Ages, partly because they say, what is the bliss of that state of liberation, since one can no longer feel pleasure and pain, or even the enjoyment of cognition, where the beauty of, as I say again, the only pleasure is not a pleasure at all. Actually, it's the marvel of difference that is absolute and infinite, and that is the only equivalent to. But as I said, there is no such thing as bliss in the salvation state of Vaisheshika, not at all.
Thank you for clarifying that. That's a point I wanted to bring out, so folks could get a sense of what this what moksha or salvation or liberation looks like in this context. You use a term in your book, soteriontology. Could you say a little bit more about that and your use of it?
The term soteriontology I came across at Haufuss. He is the one who used it first, to my knowledge, and is a compound of two words, soterio, so from salvation, from soteriology, from state of salvation, and ontology. Well, he says that this term may apply not only to Vaisheshika, but to Mahayana Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta. He wanted to write a book on these three approaches, exclusively focused on soteriontology, which is describing salvation as a purely ontological matter. Is not it's not necessarily a gnostic form of ontology. By that I mean it's not necessarily related to an absolute revelation of knowledge to which a self arrives at, but rather to a state where the soul finds its own ultimate, indefinite, irreversible identity. So this is what I mean by soteriontology. I mean that salvation is not necessarily gnostic or a mental form of enjoyment, is not a spatial dwelling, but rather is a state. And this state, this nature of the self, is what drives the systems of Vaisheshika, Advaita Vedanta, and Mahayana Buddhism, according to Haufuss. And I think he's right.
And what will the alternative view be? What is this being contrasted against? Who might rebut this? How else can we think about this?
I think Vaisheshika is different in by contrast or in relation to the Vedic worldview, who saw salvation in terms of heaven, which means, as a result, movement, changes because of the law of karma, which exists and pervades all heavens. It's a major step forward in philosophy in ancient India to move from a dynamic form of liberation, the one that produced rebirth, for example, in the Vedic worldview and other systems. And this philosophical movement, which put forward a salvation which is static. So it distinguishes, to respond to your question, the static view of liberation, which is the philosophical liberation, from a dynamic form of liberation, the heaven, Svarga, as we have it in the Vedic worldview.
So I understand what you're saying in terms of the contrast between the Vedic worldview's idea of the soteriology in the Vedic worldview is very different from what we find in the classical Indian worldview. Would you say then that, for example, the six classical Indian schools of thought would be united in this respect? Or would you say that this is still more unique to Vaisheshika?
Well, we cannot generalize that easily. For example, Mimamsakas have a slightly different view than Vaisheshikas in terms of that. They, to my knowledge, still talk about Brahma Loka and also layers of Vedanta religions and philosophies. Some of them talk about Brahma Loka, which is irreversible state. Others talk about a complete identity with Brahman. So we cannot easily generalize. There are emphases, different emphases, which these six schools, there are more than six schools, this is just a generic term, number. There are considerable differences in terms of the description of that particular soteriological state.
How did you become interested in this? Like, what's the genesis of this line of thought or interest or this project?
Well, there are about three questions within your question. First of all, I should be probably asked, why am I interested in Indian philosophy? Second question would be, why philosophy and not Indian epics? And third question, why Vaisheshika? Well, I will respond only to the first question, which I hope will be sufficient enough to answer all other questions. Namely, I liked Indian worldview because it provides a unified worldview on reality as a whole. Reality is the subject matter of philosophy, either Western or Chinese or Indian and so forth. And by this unified view on reality, I mean the sense, the relations that Indian view draws between the self, the metaphysics of the selves. After all, the doctrine of the soul is a philosophical topic because we don't have easy scientific proofs. So it's a metaphysics form of knowledge, and the relationship between this metaphysics with the external or the empirical world. I feel that, or I have been frustrated to see among philosophical schools and in many religions, a sharp distinction between metaphysics and reality, the empirical world, a sharp distinction between science and religion, between philosophy and theology. After all, Indian philosophy was useful to me precisely because it provided more answers in terms of the relationship, the tight relationship that exists between soul and cosmos, reality, external reality, and internal reality. So this is, in short, what I wanted to see.
So that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you were drawn to Indian systems of thought, philosophical thought, because in your perspective there is more of a cohesion or an attempt to account for empirical reality. Is this an approximation of what you're saying?
Exactly. Yes, I was awakened to the fact that reality and the external world is a place insufficiently known from an ontological point of view. We discuss the nature of essence, substance in scholastic philosophy, for example, but we don't necessarily realize nowadays the importance of knowing the world from a metaphysical perspective. We study the world from an empirical perspective, which is a reductionist, but not from a metaphysical perspective as well. So what I wanted to do with this research is to understand the world, the empirical world, from both perspectives.
There's so many interesting ideas in what you're putting forth. I often, in my own musing, see a sort of a duality to our experience as human beings, and that there is an objective empirical world that can be measured and manipulated through what we loosely call science. And there's also a subjective metaphysical world, if you will, that we enter into and participate in just by function of being human and being conscious. And it seems to me these two modes are at odds, might be a little harsh. I don't necessarily feel that religion or spirituality and science should be as at odds as they are, perhaps in our times. But I do see them as sort of fundamentally different, in that while the empirical realities and truths are demonstrable, it seems to me that metaphysical insights, realities, truths, I don't mean illusions or strictly subjective perspectives. I mean what we can think of perhaps as truth if five individuals have all realized the same truth, but that truth is metaphysical and it's not demonstrable in the way that scientific truths are. So what I'm musing on here is this idea that I always see them sort of working in different directions or not entirely compatible in their methods. So I really find what you're saying fascinating, because you see them as more of a propensity for integration between these two modes, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Exactly. In fact, the question that, for example, Dan Scotus in the 13th century would address, and many scholastics some time ago, would be, is any between substance and qualities, between essence and esse. Essence and esse. Esse would be the correspondent of existentiality. Is there any this real, sharp, fundamental distinction, or is just an informal distinction where this distinction that we have put in science, in education, over the last, let's say, probably over the last 800 years, has brought us to the this debate of whether reality, in reality, in our reality, there is a real distinction or an informal distinction. It's something that has been defeated by the view that there is a fundamental real distinction. And that is not the view of Dan Scotus I have quoted earlier. But as I said, this fundamental question between the sharp separation between metaphysics and ontology, many people nowadays use only metaphysics for ontology. In fact, for me, there is a distinction there between metaphysics and ontology. Ontology is more oriented towards the empirical world, towards sciences, whereas metaphysics is more toward towards theology and philosophy and religion. So between these two realms have, for the last 800 years, has been a very, very thorny debate whether there is a real distinction between the two or just an informal distinction. Formal distinction, sorry.
So, thank you for the perspective. Do you feel that the insights of what you study, sort of Vaisheshika as a system of thought, is it inextricable from this doctrine of samsara and karma, or do you think that there is utility there, irrespective of subscribing to a samsaric worldview?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. If you could reformulate it, that would be very...
What I'm asking is that there's... do you think Vaisheshika philosophy is at all useful independent of this soteriology of trying to escape the wheel of karma and rebirth? Or do you think that it necessarily functions and has value within the perspective of samsara and rebirth?
I think it does have value has value in that it puts forward a solution, an original solution to the rebirth theory, and namely by removing from the soul its emotional qualities, because all nine specific qualities that are removed in liberation or before liberation are all emotional in character. So whether Vaisheshika soteriology is attractive or not, it does, in its own original way, respond to karma theory, and it explains how that has been annihilated, the karmic law, how it is annihilated, namely by removing the static essence of a substance from its dynamic qualities, the nine I mentioned earlier.
Was there anything else about the book that you hoped you would touch on today?
There were other questions I was looking at, but for the time being, I would prefer to not to talk about them, because I want to transform them into a next project on a philosophy of difference in a comparative mode with parallels.
So tell us about your next project. That'd be a great way to close.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking to look at Dvaita Vedanta, which is a school that somehow continues the worldview and the philosophical point of view of Vaisheshikas by describing reality as differentiated and yet unified, and yet on realistic terms, not idealistic terms like the rival school of Advaita Vedanta. And that particular school, and namely the category of Vaisheshika, is something I would like to explain more in relation to equivalent terms which we have in other textual traditions, such as Byzantine philosophy or even Latin scholasticism. I will not disclose more about this project, but it's something I'm working on at the moment.
Certainly sounds like interesting work. That's great. So we've probably taken enough of your time for today, so I think we'll close now. For those of you out there listening, we have been talking about salvation in Indian philosophy, perfection and simplicity for Vaisheshika. This is one of the recent additions to the Rutledge Hindu Studies series. And we've been speaking with its author, Dr. Yanut Moyes, who is a tutor in comparative philosophy at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
And for those of you out there, keep reading, keep listening, stay safe. Take care.